I'm very, very glad that Erica could be here today. And what I most of all for the quality of your science, as for of course all of our invited speakers. But what I really find appealing about Erica's approach to science is that she rolls together cell biology, developmental biology, and genetics all into one comprehensive package of a paper or papers. And really that approach has enabled her to extract general principles from her results, general principles that govern stem cell behavior. And just to give you two examples, one would be how the daughter cells of a stem cell division are instructed or told either to remain as stem cells or undergo differentiation. And the second is how you can have two populations of stem cells that will give rise to different differentiated cell types, how those two populations can exist, coexist in the same compartment or same environment and learn to get along with each other. So I don't know if we're going to hear about either of those stories today, but it's a real pleasure to have Erica here today, and I will turn the platform over.
That was stunning. I've never seen such a creative introduction in my life. That's really wonderful. And also, you guys have a fabulous research community here. I hope you don't take it for granted. I don't think, you know, this is typical of any place in the States, having this many people with an interest in reproduction that get together and synergize like this. So I really enjoyed getting to know some of you, and I think you're very fortunate. And also, thanks for your patience. I know it's getting to be kind of a long day, and now you're going to hear about something that you might feel like you didn't really need to know about. But I hope I can convince you that you'll be glad that when you get to come home tonight, that you can turn to your partner, your friends, and say, guess what? There are stem cells in fruit flies, and you would not believe where they are. So I'm going to give you that ability, at least. Okay. So, and I'll start by acknowledging Phyllis Etier, who has just completed her PhD, and I'm going to tell you some of her thesis work. And I'll also, she's done this in conjunction with Maggie DeCuevas, the long-term research associate in my group. And then I'll also tell you a story from Ching Ma, who's in her fourth year of graduate school. And there will be three parts. I'm going to spend some time introducing you to the stem cells that we study, and just in general what a niche is, so that we're all on the same page. And then I'll tell you Phyllis's work that's really revealed that there can be transdifferentiation, or the conversion of one cell type to another, within an intact stem cell niche, and the important implications that has for stem cell biology in general. And then I'll tell you this new story that was completely unanticipated, but very much motivated by some beautiful work in mammalian gonads, where we found that the stem cells in the fly testis can actually change their sex in the adult testis. And so that's what I'll be talking about. And to start with, what's a stem cell niche? Okay. So as Hugh alluded to, work from our group and several others who have begun to use simple systems like flies to study stem cells has revealed a general model that seemed to apply to many mammalian tissues, wherein, so this idea comes from an old idea. It comes from hematopoietic stem cell biologists realizing that there might be special local microenvironments that regulate stem cells. And so in general, it's thought that some cells create a niche by signaling locally, and cells that are within that niche activate a different program of gene expression than cells that are outside the niche, and that's basically how you can maintain a stem cell long term. And so a very big question overall for many stem cell biologists is, what are the features of these niches? And it turns out that's usually really challenging, because in most cases there's no way to distinguish the stem cells from their differentiating daughters. They look exactly the same morphologically. In often cases, they're very, very, very similar molecularly. And in often cases, you don't see something that's an obvious niche morphologically. And so this remains a very big topic of investigation. But we do this work in fruit flies because they have some anatomic features that have made this a lot easier. And then, as you all were subjected to somewhere along your education, you probably had to look at a fly and his eyes and learn a little genetics. The genetics is a very powerful tool for us, and the whole community of people worldwide share these transgenic flies. It's so easy. You just put them in the mail. It's not, you know, and they go. They go around the world, and they arrive, and as long as it wasn't freezing cold that day, they're okay. And so it's a really a very facile system. And we love what you guys are all doing to study the stem cells in mammals, especially this very, very elegant work from the Brinster Group. And as you can see, you can transplant stem cells that are genetically marked into a mouse testis, and they will colonize this. And depending on if you have a few or even more stem cells in the transplant, you can characterize the behavior of these cells over time. You can do beautiful, elegant, but laborious genetics to understand the regulation of these cells. So we very much appreciate learning everything that you guys are doing there. But there are some questions that are very hard to address in this tissue. Number one, where is the niche? Okay? We might be looking at it. It's hard to say. I think you all recognize this is a beautiful SEM of a testis tubule, and you can see the spermatogonia and the stem cells. They look just the same. They're sitting here on the basement membrane. The more differentiating germ cells are moving toward the lumen. And we've been hearing about sperm a little already. So this remains a question. And there's a lot of activity trying to unravel that right now. In contrast, and by the way, there's a mind-boggling number of those tubules in every testis. It's incredible. So we go with one tubule here, all right? So this is a single fly testis, and it is just one tube. And some people ask me, you know, can you do those transplants like they do in the mouse? This is what happens when you stick a needle into this tissue. Do you see these things here? Those are the sperm. It's just exploded, okay? So you're definitely not putting that back into the fly to see what happens next. Okay, so we don't have any beautiful transplant assays, but we have really potent genetic tools, and so we prefer to just, basically we made a lot of different flies together, wait, and then look at their testes and see what we caused. And so that's our real approach, and that's a very strong approach. So the testis has one niche, and we know exactly where it is. This is the same tube you just saw, but now we didn't pop this one open. And we just laid it on a microscope slide and stained for DNA. At this end here, the blunt end, it's boxed because this is where the stem cells and their immediate spermatogonial progeny are. And then the rest of the tube is full of differentiating germ cells that are going to eventually exit out this duct. You can see spermatid nuclei in bundles here. They're going to leave here. There's a great deal of conservation in the process of spermatogenesis, whether we're talking a fruit fly, a fish, a mouse, a person. And that's a very helpful thing. So if you look ultrastructurally, and you section it just the right place in the tip of the testis, you will capture an image of the niche. This is the hub. Okay, the hub is going to keep coming up here because it is what the stem cells attach to. So these yellow cells are the spermatogonial stem cells, and I've translated it into fly for anybody who really knows what we call them in flies or fish, germline stem cells. And you're all familiar with Sertoli cells, which are very cool cells, of course. And now in fish and flies, the differentiation of germ cells is a little different. Instead of having a really long-lived somatic support cell that stays there for the life of the animal and supports generation after generation of germ cells, in this case, and if you were in a fish, you would be looking at a situation where somatic stem cells cooperate with the germline stem cells to produce these gonial cells. This is a spermatogonium, and it is going to make a cluster of sperm, whereas the stem cell is going to remain in the niche. And the somatic support cells come from this stem cell. So they're not long-lived. Instead, they're generated over and over again. So it's two for one. As Hugh said, we've been able to use this as a way to understand how stem cells cooperate within a niche. And I'm not going to actually talk about that today. So important point, we know where the niche is. We know where to find it. And we also have been able to, over the years, figure out quite a lot about the signals that are important for keeping the stem cells as such. So you don't have to memorize any of this, but these should be familiar signals. As you know, there's a great deal of molecular conservation. As a matter of fact, if it were not for the Nobel Prize-winning work on flies, we probably wouldn't know a lot of these signaling pathways. And so we have local signals that are emitted from the hub, and they impinge on cells nearby, and that prevents them from differentiating. Cells that are further away from these signals have a different milieu, and they begin to differentiate. And so this set of cells here in the hub, they're somatic cells, they're quiescent, and we're going to come back to that. And these stem cells, the germline and the somatic stem cells that are dividing in concert, are always active. They're not quiescent at any point, and they actually are there even in a very old fly, which is about a couple months old. They're still there, and they're still active. They're a tiny bit less stem cells, and they might divide a tiny bit less often, but it's all still working. Okay, so I think that's what I want to say about introducing you to the tissue and the cells. Oh, I should also mention, just to reinforce, when the daughter that's going to differentiate in the germline breaks off from the stem cell, it gets an envelope of somatic cells. A pair of somatic cells wrap around that germ cell, and they seal it up, and they are going to accompany that cell as it divides into 2, 4, 8, and 16 interconnected germ cells, just like cells are interconnected in a mammalian testis. Of course, they are here too. But it's got its own personal wrapper of cells so that you can puncture this tissue and they will flow out as individual cysts. Okay? So that's it's a big anatomical distinction. Okay. So I think that's all I want to say about introducing you to what's going on in terms of cells. And for a long time, it was thought that this whole process of differentiation was really a one-way street, and that when cells left the niche, they were irreversibly committed to becoming differentiating cells. And we inadvertently figured out a few years ago that this was actually not the case. And that just came from basically curiosity. We wondered what would happen if we could kill all of the germline stem cells in the testis. We wondered, would the remaining cells actually have a chance to repopulate the tissue or not? And we weren't expecting anything to happen. We were expecting it to become empty. But it turns out that when you do that and you kill all of these original germline stem cells, that as long as there are some spermatogonia left in the tissue, that they can actually reverse. They break apart from clusters into single cells and become functional stem cells. And so that was fairly surprising. And it was actually concordant with some very old models proposed here a long time ago about how spermatogonial stem cells may operate. And that prompted other people to go ahead and test these hypotheses in the mouse testis as well. And so it seems like this might be a conserved feature of many stem cell niches, but you really would never be able to see it unless you can distinguish, finally, stem cells from differentiating cells. So that's an advantage here. Okay. So the story I'm going to tell you about next is just coming from another very simple question. I tried to make this a really simple question because I wanted to help out the student who had this project. I got to give her like something that's really going to work, you know, something that's just definitely going to be easy. And it turned out that it was incredibly hard. And that was just because technically, so Phyllis set out to do some targeted ablations in these cells, and she wanted to kill all of these somatic stem cells. It took many, many trials and errors of different combinations of death-inducing genes and tools to express them to achieve that. But she was very tenacious, and I don't think anybody else in my lab would have achieved this. And in the end, what she's learned is that if you ablate all these somatic cells in the testis, they're replaced. So in cartoon, she can kill all of these, and if she lets everything recover, they return. And the way she does that is by lineage specifically expressing pro-apoptotic genes in these stem cells. And then if she reduces apoptosis by removing the conditional expression, everything can look normal again. So that was very intriguing and then took several years of puzzling and experimenting to understand. Okay, and I should say, just for numbers, if it helps you, there's about 20 hub cells in every testis. There's the number of germline stem cells is specific to each strain. I know mice people like to talk about strains. and so it's strain specific, and so you have to be very careful when you're counting them to be matching them genetically. And there are about twice as many of these somatic stem cells as there are germline stem cells, probably because they make two wrappers for every daughter of the germline. Okay, so what did we really do to figure this out? This is how we normally look at the testis. We don't do ultrastructure. We do confocal microscopy. And so this is how we look at them. And then we don't just look at one slice, even though you're going to look at one slice. We look at 20 serially overlapping Z-series to quantify all these things. But I hope you can notice from this picture that this is the hub. All the DNA is in blue, DAPI. All of the germline is VASA in red. And we have a stain on there that helps you see the nuclei of the somatic lineage. So you can see a very faint stain in the hub, but then very bright stain in this nucleus. That's a somatic stem cell. These are daughters here. Okay, so that's what you're looking at. And this is a normal testis. And if we induce apoptosis, the picture changes a lot. So in comparison to this tissue that's all full of cells, instead you have a hub and a few wimpy-looking germline cells left. But importantly, all these somatic cells here are gone, okay? And that did take a couple of years to get to happen, I'm sorry to say. Okay, so what are these germ cells? It turns out that some of them are germline stem cells, some of them might be slightly older, but what happens is when we withdraw this condition and let everything return to normal, we see two categories. Empty with just a hub, which is what we had expected to see, and rather full with the hub, germline stem cells, somatic cells, differentiating cells. And that was really striking because this is all that's left typically to make all of this stuff. So what was really going on? So to sum, I've shown you that we can kill all of these and they come back. And to figure out what was going on, we just repeated this experiment over and over and over and over again with lots of different stains. And the first thing we did was look at the hub cell's behavior. So normally, you can stain testes until you fall over dead and you will not find a mitotic hub cell. So in this case, the hub is expressing adherence junction markers because the hub cells are highly adherent to one another. They're highly epithelialized. And so you would never normally see a hub cell expressing this, which is a mitotic marker, phosphohistone H3. That is a somatic stem cell in mitosis. Okay. However, when we took this same stain and went and looked at our testes where we had ablated all the somatic stem cells, we started to see, voila, hub cells in mitosis, something we didn't think was even possible. As a matter of fact, we had always ignorantly called, we being the whole field, called hub cells quiescent, but I actually had to go look it up at this point and learn that quiescence means reversible entry and exit into the cell cycle, whereas senescence means irreversible. And honestly, there are very few examples where people understand how you reverse from a quiescent state to an active state in a tissue. It's very much easier to study that in cell culture. So here we have a hub cell dividing, and we looked then and said, okay, well, how long does this happen? Is the hub strange for the rest of its life, or is this a temporary behavior? So when we looked at increasing numbers of days of recovery, during which the testis gets fuller and fuller of cells, if it's going to be in that fortunate majority of testes that refill, you can see that about 12% of them at the first time point where we start to see division have a dividing hub cell. Sometimes there are two, usually it's only one. And that happens for several days, but by about day six, it's very hard to see. Less than 1% are still dividing then. And by a week, we really don't see them dividing anymore. Importantly, we confirmed that this is not just S phase that they're going through, but we can also detect them going through S phase with EDU or BRDU labeling. So the hub cells are transiently exiting quiescence during the repopulation of this tissue. So that was very suggestive that maybe the hub cells are losing quiescence and contributing to this stem cell pool. And it led us to ask a very strange question, because this really has not been shown before in a stem cell niche. do the hub cells actually change their fate and become somatic stem cells? These are two different cell types. They have very different jobs. They express different genes. But this was what we were forced to ask. So we repeated this experiment. And while doing it, Kat talked earlier about her very elegant GFP studies, where she used GFP as a transient marker of cells, right? So think about that right now, because that's what I'm going to show you here. We have a GFP expressed in the hub, right here. It's only in the hub, and it's beautifully strongly expressed in the hub. And on the same tissue, you can see these pink nuclei are all our somatic stem cells and their daughters. This testis is totally normal because we haven't ablated things yet. After we ablate, the pink nuclei are gone. We killed them. The hub still expressing GFP, and the GFP is still confined to the hub. But 3 days later, we see something really different. The hub is now looking much more diffuse, and you can see co-expression of this cis stem cell and cis cell marker along with the green hub cell marker. That got us really excited. And as expected, now we know these hub cells are only going to be dividing for about a week. So if you wait a week or two, this is the 2 week example, the hub expression of this marker has become confined to the hub again. And things have returned to what looked like a pretty normal situation. Okay, so we have no more of this green marker co-localizing with the somatic stem cell label. So this supports this hypothesis that hub cells are actually transdifferentiating into these new stem cells. And this is induced by killing the original set of stem cells and leaving the niche sitting there with just a hub and some germ cells. The other thing that we saw that we really didn't expect was that in these testes that recover, about half the time they get one niche, but this is an example of a testis that got eight of them. And so I don't even have to point, but I will point. You can see hub here with the GFP marker. These are somatic stem cells. This is another one here. There's another one down below here, and there's even more that are out of these focal planes. This is something no one has ever seen before. And so we have no idea how these ectopic niches are actually showing up, but we know that it's a consequence of our damage to the tissue. We know that killing the original set of stem cells and forcing the hub to do something it would have normally never done is causing a big mistake in the tissue. And so I'll summarize what I've said so far. I've shown you that you can ablate the somatic stem cells, and that triggers loss of quiescence in the hub. But it's temporary, and the hub will stop dividing after the niche is refilled. And our best evidence so far is that the replacement stem cells are coming directly from the hub. And this is often, this is about half the cases, accompanied by getting ectopic stem cell niches. And importantly, we have looked in flies where we have permanently marked the hub with genetic lineage tracing and then subjected them to every kind of damage we can think of. And not the water swimming test, but that's for mice. But we've irradiated them, we've aged them, we've starved them. Interestingly, starving them depletes half of their somatic stem cells, and then when you put them back onto happy food, they get them back. And even that was not sufficient to trick the hub into doing this. So we think that this is something that's a unique response to losing all of the stem cells. Okay, not a physiological thing. This is not how you normally want to replace your stem cells, because look at what happens half the time. That's not so effective. It turns out, I always wondered, now I know, why is there only one niche? It turns out when there are a whole bunch of niches, the whole tissue fails. It gets really confused. You get a big blob of germ cells that really don't make it all the way through the program anymore. So more is not better in the case of stem cell niches in this tissue. But I just also have to add that nobody really understands how you control the number of stem cell niches in any tissue. So right out of the sky, this opportunity to study this question has landed in our laps. So we're excited about that. Okay, and so I think now I want to make a parallel to some really interesting ways of thinking about metaplasia in people, because we all even like mice, but we like people even better. And so When I'm showing you that these quiescent hub cells can wake up and become stem cells, this is an interesting parallel. The McEwen lab, who's now at Bar Harbor, has proposed that at the junction of certain tissues, in this example it happens to be the junction between the esophagus and the stomach, he's identified a set of cells that are quiescent, and he's named them residual embryonic cells. And in their working hypothesis, these RECs are the cells that lose quiescence upon damage. So, okay, anybody my age has heard of acid reflux. Anybody who watches television who's younger has heard of it too, although younger people don't even watch television. Anyway, what happens is enough acid refluxing into the esophagus hurts that epithelial structure, and it is thought to kill those cells. And with enough damage over time, it turns out that these quiescent cells will actually lose quiescence and start to divide and make a replacement epithelia at this junction between the esophagus and the stomach. And that would be all fine if they were making these pink squamous cells that normally line the esophagus, but no, they're not doing that. They're making the wrong kind of epithelia. They're making something that looks a lot like the down here, the intestinal epithelia. It's not even stomach epithelia. And so that has been a very provocative finding that people have wondered how the heck you get these cells. And this is controversial about the cell of origin for this pre-metaplastic lesion. But I just thought that it was very striking to think that there might be a lot of other situations where recruiting quiescent cells into mitotic activity to repair a damaged tissue turns out to make the wrong kind of repair in a tissue. So we're very curious to understand, of course, what are the molecular changes? This hub is obviously very different than the original hub when it's going into this process. And we're hoping to use fly genetics now to really piece together the series of events that tells this cell to lose quiescence and then re-enter quiescence and to transdifferentiate. And we think that all those extra niches are actually coming. I showed you the picture where the cell was co-expressing the hub marker and the stem cell lineage marker. Well, we've done that with multiple markers. And so we think that they exist in an indeterminate state where they're partially hub-like and partially stem cell-like, and that if there are enough of those indeterminate cells that they might actually get together and signal to each other to make these ectopic niches. But that right now is just pure speculation. But that's what we will start with as a model. Okay. So I'm going to tell you the next story. But Hugh, you should tell me how much time I have left. Danger. All right. Well, because I can stop now if it's... No? Okay. Okay. What matters most to me is that you guys understand what I'm saying, not the volume of material I deliver to you. So, and normally I actually ask people to ask me questions while I'm talking, but you guys seem very, you know, you're wearing nice clothes and you're being very polite. So I won't traumatize you, but... Okay, it's hard for me. So, the next story comes from a completely unexpected finding. And I told you a few slides ago that one of the local signals that's really important in this niche is the JAK-STAT pathway, and that's cytokine signaling. The analogous receptor would be LIF receptor, which if any of you have ever tried to culture ES cells, you know you need to have LIF in your media. Okay, so you're familiar with JAK-STAT. Luckily for us, that pathway had been well characterized in mammals when we stumbled upon it as having a role in maintaining both the germline and the somatic stem cell in this tissue. And so one of the main questions has been, well, what could STAT be activating in these cells to make them stem cells? Because the targets of that gene should be very informative. Well, one of the targets is a gene called CHINMO. And that has been characterized by Erica Bock's lab at NYU as being a repressor that prevents stem cell differentiation in this somatic stem cell lineage. It doesn't act here in the germline stem cell. It's just in the soma. And so it's downstream of STAT, and when it's activated by STAT, it's preventing the stem cell from differentiating. Another way to say it, it's promoting stem cell fate. Okay? So, complete loss of CHINMO in this cell causes the stem cell to just differentiate. It turns into a differentiating cyst cell and just gets flushed right out of the tissue. They're not around for long. Okay. However, what is this title coming from? Well, it turns out not only, oh, I should tell you too, because you're mouse people and human people, that there's a homolog, and it's a ZFP protein in mice that really hasn't been characterized. And this is a BTB zinc finger repressor for people that like to think about molecular structures. And so I already told you, you don't need CHINMO at all in the germline, just in the soma. So we're only going to be talking about the somatic stem cells now. And I'm going to tell you that we've learned unexpectedly that if you reduce CHINMO, you get something very different than when you knock it out entirely. You actually get these somatic stem cells transforming into female cells. And then we can make this happen in an adult testis, which is very striking. So normally, the somatic cells in the testis of a fly are going to make these green squamous cyst cells that wrap around the germ cells. I've told you that already. I didn't tell you that the ovary has a very beautiful arrangement of somatic cells. They're columnar follicle cells here, a beautiful epithelial layer that surround the germline. Okay, and this is a younger egg chamber with germ cells surrounded by a follicle cell layer. So you can see morphologically the soma is very different in a testis and an ovary. Okay, this is the mutation that made us stop and wonder what the heck was going on, because you can see that this is a testis, first of all. It came out of a male fly. But you'll see that there's this layer of columnar epithelial cells lining it, and then these are the germ cells inside, but they're not differentiating properly. They're stuck in an indeterminate phase. So we thought, wow, this looks like something kind of in between these two things. It looks like it has the soma of the ovary and then germ cells that are arrested. And you guys probably all know that the sex of the germline and the soma has to match in order to get oogenesis or spermatogenesis, whether you're a fly or a human. If those are mismatched, it does not work. Okay. So these are arrested spermatogonia, and we know that they express a male marker. But what about the soma? What's really happening there? Is it becoming feminized? And so we're scratching our heads, like, what is there that we can look at that's only expressed in the ovary and not in the testis? And luckily, we do all this with thesis committees, and one of our smart thesis committee members said, yolk. We're like, yes, egg, yolk. Okay. So luckily, this turned out to be the case, that normally you don't see any yolk protein in testes, but you do see it in the ovaries. And then when you look in these CHINMO mutants, as expected, it's in the ovary, but it's present in the testis, here in this mutant and in this mutant as well. So we have bands here and here that we never expected to see. That was a nice suggestion that we were getting a female transformation of the soma in the testis. Okay, but was that good enough? No, not good enough entirely. There have to be more characterization, because this has never been shown before at all. And when that happens to you, you have an extra burden of showing it over and over again a lot of different ways. But also, we were fascinated to be able to study this, because no one had ever transformed the sex of a cell in an adult gonad before and seen it in this tissue. And very little is known about that in mammalian gonads, but it does happen. And there's some beautiful work going on from several labs now regarding that. So here's our wild-type testis, and it doesn't express this GFP at all. This GFP is expressed in these older follicle cells that are in an ovary surrounding the developing oocyte. This is a slightly younger egg chamber, so you'll see this GFP here in these follicle cells. And sure enough, in our testes, as these progress, so here are some of those columnar cells that are negative, but then these cells here that are morphologically a little bit bigger have started to turn on this marker of the female soma. So we thought, okay, this really looks like they're turning into ovarian soma in the testis. So we looked at several more markers, and I will not bother to show you all of them. And we also confirmed that the cells are dividing, and that's why there get to be more and more of them, and that's typical of the female but not the male soma. And so this gave us the hypothesis that CHINMO is necessary to promote the male identity of the somatic stem cells in the testis. And so we were left with just two questions. Which cell types in the testis require this gene? And what are the molecular mechanisms? And so for the cell type requirement, we did a cell-specific RNAi knockdown. And when we knocked it down, so we could take flies and knock down this gene in the adult somatic stem cells and look for the phenotype. And this is what the testes looked like before induction of RNAi. So you can see the hub and the germline stem cells and the differentiating spermatogonia and spermatocytes. And in this experimental testis, actually this is the same genotype. This is just before and after induction of RNAi. I hope you can tell this looks nothing like a normal testis anymore. Instead, it looks very much like our CHINMO mutant allele. So you can see you're starting to pile up these little columns of epithelial cells that extend along the basement membrane of the tissue, and the germ cells inside are arrested. So that was very exciting, because this told us that it was certainly a defect that could be induced in an adult tissue and not something that happened during development. And so that says that this is actually all about sex maintenance, because really not that much attention has been given to the thought that, just like I told you that not so much is known about how you actively maintain the state of quiescence in a tissue, well, not as much is known about how you actively maintain sexual identity in a tissue. You would think you would just take care of it in the beginning and be done with it. But it turns out experiments like this show that you actually have to keep remembering to be male all the time. Okay, so I'll tell you next that we got no phenotype whatsoever when we did the same experiment and drove it in these older somatic cells out here or in the hub. So that really narrowed down the requirement to the somatic stem cells. So that's the answer. And actually, to our knowledge, this is the first time anybody has shown that a stem cell in an adult tissue can change its sexual identity. And so we're left with the molecular mechanism question. And obviously, we needed to sort of look about into the canonical sex determination pathway. And anybody, I don't know if you learned this in high school. High school is more advanced than when I was in high school. I certainly didn't learn it, but you probably learned it in college, this canonical splicing cascade in Drosophila, where you have sex lethal, trough female form, and double sex F. And I just have to admit that even though I love genetics, when people used to talk about this, I would stop listening, because it was just, it got very intricate and people were very excited about all the little details. But the truth is, these factors here, double sex, female form, male form, you've heard about those because that's DMRT1, right? So that's familiar, right? And it's conserved. These upstream factors aren't even found in like houseflies. But this factor here is necessary and sufficient to maintain male somatic sex in the adult mouse testis, and that's been beautifully shown recently by the Zarkover lab. So we were extra motivated to keep figuring this out based on knowing this. So does CHINMO interact with double sex? First, we had to go and look and see if it was present or absent in our mutant testes. So this is what double sex looks like in a normal testis. It's green. You can see it in the hub, you can see it in the somatic stem cells, you can see it in some cyst cells. And it's not in the germline, because in flies, the germline has a different molecular mechanism that's not well understood for maintenance and establishment of sex. So this is double sex M normally. And then when we look in our CHINMO mutant testes, when the fly has just hatched and is 1 day old, a very fresh fly, you can see the hub here. You can see some stem cells are still positive for double sex M, but these cells here are actually losing expression of this factor. And when we look a little bit longer, you can see that all this somatic stuff here that's piling up, those are those epithelial cells, they have lost double sex M, that male form of double sex. So that was pretty nice, because that's all consistent with them becoming female cells. They're losing the male marker in the soma. And so we also asked, well, if we push on the female form of double sex or its upstream counterpart, TRA, in an adult testis, is this good enough to cause anything to happen? And so that's what this data is here. So this is a sibling control testis with no epithelial cells anywhere. And then we can see these little patches of epithelialized soma showing up in testes. And all we did here was take a normal fly and make double sex female come on at high levels in the testis soma. Okay? So that was also very consistent with this model. So I'm going to sum up. I'm going to tell you that are working on processes that you need to have CHINMO to inhibit female factors and promote maleness in these stem cells in the adult testis. And so that CHINMO actually probably has a lot of targets. We know from previous work that it's got to have some targets that maintain stem cell identity per se. So that would be its ability to repress differentiation factors, because we told you already to begin with, if you take it away entirely, the stem cells leave. But all of this work is showing us that it actually has another role besides that that's quite unexpected, and that is that it is able to repress genes that would normally promote a female state. And what these are, we're very curious to know. We don't know the molecular arrangement. We don't know what CHINMO sits on in these cells, because, of course, there aren't that many stem cells in the testis, and we have to work out a way to get our hands on just those cells to be starting to do our chip experiments here. But that's where we're headed. Okay, and so I think this also implies that there will be some genes that it binds with high affinity, and other genes, these sexual identity promoting genes, that it binds with lower affinity, and that would explain why just reducing this is enough to give us one of these phenotypes but still maintain the stem cells, because the stem cells are still okay, but they turn into female cells when we reduce CHINMO. So I guess they're not really that okay. All right, so overall summary, I've just told you two stories, and I hope you're convinced that it's useful to study stem cells in fly testes, because we really do stumble on these things that seem to be pretty interesting generally about stem cell biology and that were not known before and are probably going to apply to lots of cases. So number one, that if you damage a niche heavily, that quiescent niche-generating cells can actually serve as reserve stem cells, but they're not so good at that. They'll make some mistakes along the way. And that stem cell maintenance factors, like this repressor CHINMO, can actually be required to maintain the sexual identity of somatic stem cells in an adult. And, of course, we're very interested to know what kind of mammalian parallels there could be, because this is understood to be operating in an adult testis, but it's a little harder to identify exactly which cells and exactly how it works. So I think it'll be really nice to approach this from two different directions. So thank you, and especially thank you to the NICHD for funding this.
Hi, my name is Carl. I have a couple questions. The first question I had was regarding the first part. I was wondering, do the somatic cells and the hub cells during testicular development, do they have a similar origin?
Yes, that's a great question. They do. They come from somatic gonadal precursors, and how they get subdivided into these two populations is not well understood yet. So, but that's a great question. Thanks for asking that. Yes.
And then the other question is about the second part. And I was wondering if the CHINMO mutants had, have you looked at CHINMO expression possible or lack thereof in female?
Oh, yes. Thanks for asking. I forgot to show that when we force CHINMO on in the female, we can actually start to see a little bit of male gene expression coming up in the female. And thanks, I forgot to mention that. yeah, which is surprising, because the other thing is all of these things that regulate sex identity, they're binary. You know, you either have the male form or the female form, but not, CHINMO is really different because it's expressed in the ovary, but it's not expressed at very high levels. And so that's why we think the affinity of the target sites is actually going to matter a lot, because it's not an all or none thing, it's a level thing. Yeah, it's a great question.
And last question. Yeah. those mutants, can they be rescued? So if you did RNAi, right? If you take that out, mm-hmm. Can you go back to a male? Do you go back to a male phenotype?
We have not tried to reverse the RNAi phenotypes yet. No, we haven't. Yeah, we could try that. What we are trying that's really kind of weird is, and so we're really compelled to do this, is we want to try to switch these germ cells all the way over into the female state. It'll probably totally mess up the tissue, but if it works even a little bit, we would be so excited. Yeah. So, yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Very nice work. My first question is, how does the hub know that there's no more somatic stem cells there? So is there factors from the stem cells going through the hub?
Yes.
And absence of that crosstalk would make the hub differentiate?
That's a very good working model, and we're desperate to know what the factors are that change. So it does imply that normally the somatic stem cells are actively promoting hub cell quiescence via signals, mm-hmm. and we are going to do our best to test all kinds of candidate signals for that. But we also think that it might be more than just one signal needed. You might need to have a repressive signal and an activating signal from whatever is left in the germline, or perhaps the weird conditions associated with the damage we're inducing. As a matter of fact, this hasn't been studied much at all, but there are macrophages sometimes in the testis, and we haven't even begun to ask where some, you know, perhaps a cell like an immune cell is coming in and participating in this whole process. So we're definitely keen to understand the changes in signaling, but we got to get our hands on lots and lots of hubs first. So any suggestions on that are absolutely welcome.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. Right, well, one primitive question. So hub, there is one hub in the normal testis. I'm talking about the left side of the slide. You get the multiple hubs and compartments after regeneration. Now, so do hub cells walk?
Do the what?
Do hub cells walk to different places, or for some reason, cyst cells reconvert back to hub cells?
So sometimes, so you're asking like the biogenesis of all this stuff, where is it coming from? Like how do you get from one to many? And we sometimes see big, really big hubs, because while that in that period where the hub cells have decided to lose quiescence, sometimes the hub grows pretty big. And sometimes they look stretched. We haven't been able to make movies of this process yet, partly because it takes several days and we can't image for that long. But we are considering the possibility that there might be a field of cells that are indeterminate and that they coalesce together to make this niche. That's our best guess right now, but we actually don't know. We sometimes see an ectopic niche that's just two hub cells with a few stem cells around it. So we really don't know right now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but I don't really follow that. But there is only one hub cell, hub first, right?
Yes, and initially there's only one.
Different places. And in the picture you showed us, you said it was 2 weeks later,
mm-hmm.
after the ablation.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if you look at them 3 days later, 1 day, 1 week later, 10 days later, do you see the hub-like cells walking through towards a different direction?
Yes.
Or
so,
some kind of conversion back to the hub cells taking place somewhere?
Okay, so when I showed you at the very beginning how the hub starts to spread out and start to co-express stem cell markers on some of those cells at the edge, and some of those will creep along the basement membrane and make a kind of a sheet of cells. That's something that we see. But who's really moving and where and how, we won't know that till we start to make movies of this. And we can make movies in here. It's just a big pain.
I also had a couple of questions about those ectopic hubs. It looks like they're not all the same size. Are they fairly uniform in size or completely
homogeneous? Some of them are really big, and some of them are sort of, sometimes we see them looking kind of like a dumbbell, which would suggest that maybe they're breaking apart, but we really don't know. It's a static picture. Yeah.
Do you have any way to approach what's regulating the size of the hub, or maybe this is related, what's causing those hub cells that woke up and started mitotic activity, causing them eventually to go back to sleep again?
So we know that we can inducibly force them into the cell cycle by expressing cyclins and CDKs and kick them into cycling. In a normal test, we can just force that hub to divide, and it gets pretty big and has a lot of stem cells around it. And we can then withdraw cycling, and it'll just stay pretty much the way we left it for a while. But we're actually not done characterizing that. We don't know if the hub will eventually, over a long period of time, shed those extra cells or not. But we've also done the reverse, where we've whacked away half the hub in a normal testis and made it half size. And it cannot really do a darn thing about that. It just stays shrunk for all we can see. So we think that the hub isn't really all that good at knowing how big it is, and that once you've altered it, it's going to stay altered. That's our hypothesis right now.